This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You say budget, I say sequester. Yeah, that's still a thing. What the White House has planned, spending-wise, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, 27th of February today, Monday. Good as always to have you along. The Marketplace number of the day to start this week is $54 billion, the amount by which President Trump plans to increase defense spending in his budget proposal, the outline of which was released today. That bump, which would be a nearly 10% addition to the Pentagon's annual budget, will be offset by reductions to domestic programs, the White House said, the caveat there being no cuts to Medicaid or Social Security. However, political reality and Congress being what they are, Marketplace's Adam Allington reports the president's budget proposal might wind up changing very little, actually, about federal spending priorities.
The president's proposal includes a massive 10% increase in defense spending, which would be offset by cuts to unspecified domestic programs and foreign aid. While that may sound like red meat for the Republican masses, there's just one little problem. Foreign aid is basically peanuts.
Overall, it's less than 1% of the total budget.
Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. The true drivers of the budget are Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all of which are subject to automatic spending increases and which President Trump has promised not to touch. And the rest of the non-defense discretionary spending is only one-third of the budget, much of which has already seen steep spending cuts.
It is on track to be the lowest that it's been in decades. So the truth is, this is a very small area of the budget.
And even within that small slice, you still have a whole bunch of very powerful interest groups, says Catherine Blakely of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
Farmers would certainly let their congressional representatives hear about it if they wanted to cut, for example, crop insurance supports.
So basically what's happening here, according to Eugene Sterley of the Urban Institute, is the latest version of what politicians always do. They want to focus on the giveaway side of the budget.
They're giving us tax cuts. They're giving us spending increases, say, in defense. They don't really want to talk too much about how they're going to pay for it.
Sterley says all of this is before Congress and the president have addressed repealing and replacing Obamacare or spending on national infrastructure projects. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Tomorrow night, 9 o'clock Washington time, by the way, probably a little bit afterwards, actually, is the president's speech to Congress on this whole thing. All right, there was a story in the Financial Times this morning that caught our eye that the White House is pondering ways to get around some of the institutions of global trade, specifically in this case, the World Trade Organization. The president's preference for one-on-one deals is well known. So we asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison what a bilateral America might look like in a multilateral world.
U.S. companies that sell abroad are hopeful about Trump policy, but wary. Dealing with nations one by one could lead to more favorable deals, but it potentially means a varied patchwork of complex rules. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
If the U.S. starts negotiating bilateral deals, U.S. exporters will not be able to count on similar levels of access or same standards across countries, which will make life a little more complicated for them.
One-on-one dealings could be more complicated for America, too.
Multi-country deals helps countries balance concessions.
That's Kathleen Cimino-Isaacs at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. When there are multiple countries around the table, the U.S. can make a concession to one country knowing it can receive one from another. Not as simple with just one-on-one talks. And this talk of breaking away from the World Trade Organization worries Matt Slaughter. He's dean of Dartmouth's Business School and was a White House economic advisor under President George W. Bush.
If the United States did walk away in part or in more dramatic fashion in whole cloth from the WTO, we would be walking away from literally generations of policy leadership that has helped grow American jobs and American wages.
He's also concerned the U.S. will have a tough time protecting its intellectual property. Going a purely bilateral route will lead to an unpredictable mix of gains and losses, but one thing is a pretty sure bet. The administration and Congress will have to work on a lot more trade deals. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here with today's lesson in, man, the ways the economy is changing is hitting everywhere. This morning, Pearson, the global education publisher, announced a nearly $3.5 billion loss for 2016. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains what's going on.
Maya Rustem is an example of the bind book publishers are in. She's a poli-sci major at Cal State University Northridge.
I used to get my textbooks from the bookstore when I was a freshman and didn't know any better.
Now she says she's smarter. She rents.
I save like $500 on books.
That's $500 a semester. According to the National Association of College Stores, spending on course materials has fallen 14% in the last 10 years, even as tuition has jumped. Students are renting or buying used books. Schools are looking for cheaper open education resources and digital materials, which is where publishers are hoping the future is. Digital textbooks, learning platforms. Pearson says it's investing nearly $930 million a year to make the transition to digital. Other publishers are scrambling, too.
This shift has been brewing for a while, but it's really happening, I think, now in really record pace.
That's David Anderson with the Association of American Publishers. He says it's not just how students get their course materials that's a challenge for publishers today. It's also the number of students enrolled. Undergraduate enrollment peaked in 2010. Howard Lurie is an analyst at EduVentures.
You know, enrollment tends to be countercyclical to the economy.
A better job market means fewer people looking for a degree and for textbooks. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, 12 straight up days for the Dow. The last time that happened, 1987. Black Monday, ring a bell? Anyone? Anyone? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Dunn County, Wisconsin, population about 44,000 or so, voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and in 2012, just like the rest of that state. And then last year, just like the rest of the state, Dunn County went for Trump. Marketplace's Annie Baxter went to the county seat, Menominee, to ask people about the big promises they hope the president will and the ones he won't, they hope, keep.
Menominee, Wisconsin is in a really pretty part of the state. It's got rolling hills, a lake, lots of dairy farms, and even the occasional cow merry-go-round. It's actually called a rotary.
They like to ride it so much that we have some cows that like to stay on. So we've had some that will go around 3-4 times if we let them.
That's Dave Steyer. At his dairy called Alphalon, workers attach milkers to the cows. And once the animals make a full rotation on the moving platform of the rotary, that round of milking is done. Steyer installed the rotary, which cost more than $1 million, around the time of a costly expansion. For decades, his family only milked a few hundred cows. Then, a couple years ago, they ramped up to nearly 2,000. Steyer says it was a gamble, but he felt like Wisconsin's pro-business Republican Governor Scott Walker had their backs.
Because if we started this and then all of a sudden faced a lot of opposition from the government regulatory side, things like that, it wouldn't have been as strong of a business climate. So that weighed into our decision to expand when we did it. That and a lot of prayers. And
in November, Steyer voted for Donald Trump. In him, Steyer saw another advocate for lower taxes and fewer regulations. That said, some of Trump's policies are causing Steyer angst.
Juan, where's Guadalupe? Guadalupe?
Many of his workers hail from Mexico. Steyer says local workers snub farm work. It's physically demanding, and cows need milking round the clock, including the middle of the night. He says if he loses workers under Trump's immigration crackdown,
it would be a major blow. No doubt about it. I don't know how else to put it.
Across town, the happy sounds of kids playing in the Noyola household belie a family on edge financially. The mom, Brianna Noyola, is a tall blonde who looks every bit of her Norwegian ancestry. She says she and her husband, Luis, are struggling.
You know, and he works two jobs. I have a job. You know, I get child support from my previous husband, and yet we're still trying to make it.
They're trying to get a green card for Luis, who's from El Salvador. He's currently in the country illegally. Luis says until he gets the green card, his work options are limited to grinding, low-paying jobs. His weekdays start at 5:30 in the morning at a foundry. Weekends, he works at a dairy, starting at 3 in the morning.
I am a hard worker. I don't want to wake up sometime to my job, but I do it. I need to do it, you know.
Because his green card application is in process, they're less worried than some families with an undocumented parent. But Trump's crackdown on Latino immigrants bothers their 13-year-old daughter, Annika. With her long, dark hair, she resembles her Mexican dad, Brianna's first husband. Annika says she doesn't like Trump. I ask her why.
Well, that he doesn't like me.
Her 4-year-old brother asks, Trump doesn't like who?
You.
The mom, Brianna Noyola, didn't vote for Trump. She went for an independent candidate. Still, the Noyolas hold out hope that Trump will improve the economy.
I really try to think positively about Trump. I mean, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, you don't want the pilot of the plane you're in to, you know, do bad.
Whether or not people here voted for Trump, they all seem to want a better economy. In Menominee, Wisconsin, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
I went 9 for 24 on my Oscars ballot last night. 9 correct guesses out of 24 categories. Not great, but hey, at least I got the big one right, Moonlight, as Best Picture. Wesley Morris writes on film and culture for the New York Times. Wesley, it's good to talk to you again.
Oh, my God. Hi. Nice to talk to you.
All right. So, along those lines, cast your mind back 18-ish, whatever it was, hours. And I want you to clear your brain of everything you have discovered since that envelope was opened. And when you heard La La Land as Best Picture, what was your first thought?
Of course.
Really?
It was of course. I was not surprised. As a professional, you know, moviegoer,
movie picker, yes.
You get used to certain results recurring with a few surprises here or there. It just seemed kind of inevitable that La La Land was going to be Best Picture. So, you know, when Faye Dunaway said La La Land in the way that she said it, it just seemed like, you know, of course.
Are you heartened at all? I mean, given all the conversations that you and I have had about big tentpole movies and how, you know, the flashy ones get all the drama, are you heartened at all that Moonlight, made for $1.5 million, that you and I have talked about as being just an exquisite picture? You must be heartened that that finally got it, right?
Oh, sure. It's great. There's no downside to Moonlight winning Best Picture at all. I do think there'll be a lot of people in various parts of the country who will be like, what is that now?
Yeah.
But I think that's more an indication of, I can't even say that it's a matter of how fractured the movie going situation is right now. I mean, under no circumstances was Moonlight ever supposed to conquer the box office.
Right.
It's made about $22 million at this point. And that's a lot of money for a movie that is about the life of one person who is a gay black male from a housing project in Miami.
Right. Back up for a minute. What do you mean that the movie going thing is so fractured now?
Well, I was going to say the way we experience our movies, we're not going to the same stuff as often as we used to be going to the same stuff.
You mean all of us as a society?
Yeah, yeah, I just feel like, you know, last night there was a Manchester by the Sea constituency. There was a Hacksaw Ridge constituency. There were the La La Land people. And there was probably, I'm going to guess, now here's some data that I'm just going to challenge someone to disprove, which is that I don't think there's a great deal of overlap among those nine movies in terms of audience. But I think that there is a way in which your identity politics and your sort of this thing we're going through where we have to sort of partisanize so many things does create these blocks.
The finale aside and that whole brouhaha, was last night a good night for the motion picture industry in this country?
I think because of that, that brouhaha, you know, I think that going into the show, the conversation was about the representation issue. Right. This year, there were clearly people of color nominated. Several of them won. I think that took a lot of the pressure off the body of the Academy. But I mean, as you and I have talked about before, that really isn't
right.
That's not really right. The issue, right? I mean, it's not the Academy's problem. It's the movie's problem.
Wesley Morris, he writes on movies and culture and a bunch of stuff for The New York Times. Thanks, man. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Coming up,
it is an agency, a federal agency that has long outlived its usefulness.
That was then, but how about now? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 15 points today, 20,837. The NASDAQ up 16 points. That's about 0.25% there, 58.61. S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.1% plus or minus 23.69. Markets are kind of playing a waiting game before President Trump's big speech to Congress tomorrow. But as we told you earlier, defense is a big winner. Thus, defense contractors got a boost today. Raytheon, world's largest producer of guided missiles, gained 0.8%. Northrop Grumman added 1.4%. Lockheed Martin climbed almost 2% today. Also on the president's mind, infrastructure, says he's going to spend big, that's a quote, to fix potholes, bridges, and tunnels, which made materials companies pretty happy. Martin Marietta Materials built up 2.4% today. Vulcan Materials lifted 2.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Quick, Wall Street, good or bad? All right, that's a false choice. Because depending on who you talk to, Wall Street and all that that phrase implies is either the very beating heart of American capitalism or it's a completely rigged system that makes the rich richer and robs the rest of us. William Cohen takes up the challenge of explaining why Wall Street matters in his book of that title, Why Wall Street Matters. Bill, it's good to have you back on.
Great to be here. Thank you, Kai.
I think we need a definition first, right? And you talk about this early in the book, what Wall Street actually is versus what people think it is.
First of all, there's basically no Wall Street firms on Wall Street anymore. The only Wall Street firm still on Wall Street is a big German bank, Deutsche Bank. But, you know, Wall Street writ large is this whole huge finance effort worldwide that provides – really importantly, provides capital to people who need it by taking it from people who have it to invest.
But let's stipulate here early on that Wall Street, with the acquiescence of a large part of the American public through, you know, refinancing their houses and taking the money out and doing all that stuff, but Wall Street did great damage to this economy in the past 10 years.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Okay.
One of the biggest mysteries still out there is why the Justice Department didn't prosecute. Now, having said that, there was a vacuum created. No one prosecuted. The American people angry. Into that vacuum stepped politicians, many of whom demagogued the issue, regulators, many of whom just delighted in the fact of, frankly, throwing sand into what is really an incredibly beautiful machine. The machine of Wall Street, the machine that has given us Apple and Google and Facebook, that is an incredible machine. I believe we need to have a fact-based debate about what Wall Street does right and what Wall Street does poorly and fix the things that it does poorly and celebrate the things that it does right.
Just on this idea of regulation, there is going to be another financial crisis. That's not very much in doubt. Your objection to the regulation that has been done so far is that what's been tried is to make it completely safe and riskless – or risk-free, rather – when in reality, you just need to mitigate the risk somehow and make it less.
And look, I worked on Wall Street for 17 years. People do what they're rewarded to do on Wall Street. If you reward them to take prudent risks, that's exactly what they'll do. If you reward them to take big risks with other people's money and have no accountability for their actions, that's what they'll do too. All I'm asking for is a marrying of smart regulation with smart rewards and smart incentives. I think we're close to the first part of that. with Donald Trump, believe it or not, and it pains me to say that, I don't hear anybody talking about the second part.
And the second part, you think, is just to be clear here, you think bankers, Wall Street writ large, they ought to be personally on the hook. When something goes south,
absolutely,
they ought to be lock, stock, and barrel. Their homes, their cars, all of that jazz,
everything,
is on the line.
Everything. By the way, just like it used to be when they were private partnerships. I mean, most of Goldman Sachs' 160-year existence was as a private partnership where the partners had, you know, most, if not all, of their full net worth on the line. Instead of doing what is obviously right for the American people by aligning the incentives of Wall Street with the outcomes the American people need, instead of having Wall Street privatize the gains and socialize the losses, which is what happened in 2008, we need to have this revamp. It needs to be a grand bargain with Donald Trump. Let the great deal maker in chief in Washington make this grand bargain with American people in Wall Street.
All right, so here comes a $64,000 question. Lay odds for me on any of this happening.
It comes down to guts, courage. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, to make this argument clearly. Now, maybe it's too much to ask that somebody will step up and be a leader. This is long overdue. This is long overdue. And it's not that hard to change, and it's not something that they're not familiar with. So just do it, because it's the right thing to do. You know, when was the last time that somebody did something just because it was the right thing to do?
Bill Cohen writes on Wall Street a lot. His latest book is called Why Wall Street Matters. It's a history lesson. It's thoughts and insights. And it's not long. It's about 150 pages. It's a good read. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Always a pleasure to be with you.
This past presidential election was not without its controversies. The eventual winner claiming during the campaign it was rigged, and since then making unsubstantiated charges that millions of people voted illegally. There's also that across-the-board consensus in the intelligence community that Russia tried to influence the outcome of our election. Nevertheless, the House Committee on Administration has voted to shut down the Federal Election Assistance Commission. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the whys and wherefores.
Remember the 2000 presidential election, that nail-biter between George W. Bush and Al Gore?
The state of Florida is too close to call.
Election officials decided to count all of the ballots by hand.
We have people shuffling ballots around like they're playing cards.
That was NBC's Brian Williams, ABC's Cokie Roberts, and Ed Pozzoli, chair of the Republican Party in Broward County, Florida, during the vote recount. Florida was the land of hanging chads, little bits of paper left dangling off of improperly punched ballots from voting machines that did not work as intended. Congress responded with legislation that established the Election Assistance Commission. Now, Republican Congressman Greg Harper of Mississippi has introduced a bill that would kill the commission. Actually, Harper has introduced this legislation several times. Here he is on the House floor in 2011.
It is an agency, a federal agency that has long outlived its usefulness.
Harper's office didn't respond to repeated requests for an interview, but in a statement on his website, he calls the commission a waste of money and says it was supposed to be temporary, closing after 3 years.
I think that's his interpretation.
That's Thomas Hicks, the chairman of the Election Assistance Commission. He says commission members are appointed to 4-year terms.
And we can be reappointed for another 4 years, so I don't know where that 3-year number is coming from.
Hicks says the commission is continuing to do its work, writing updated standards new voting machines will have to meet on things like cybersecurity. The commission also teaches local election officials how to keep the old, creaky voting machines they have now safe from, say, Russian hackers.
Some of these machines might have some form that allow them to talk to other machines or, you know, be hooked up to the Internet. But we tell folks to make sure that those things are turned off.
The League of Women Voters says this type of guidance is especially important now. Lloyd Leonard is the League's advocacy director.
We have seen attempts by foreigners to affect the election. We believe that our voting machines are secure, and they are, but we need to be on guard.
Plus, Leonard says the advanced age of the voting machines we're using now has led to other controversies about access to voting and the counting of votes.
There have been concerns about whether the old machines accurately record the votes. There have been problems just turning some of them on. There have been problems of some of them just shutting down.
Leonard says if Congress did kill the Election Assistance Commission, states could still buy new voting machines. But without the commission around to write updated standards, those machines wouldn't have to meet any new tests for things like cybersecurity or accuracy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, in which the global economy comes to East Longmeadow, Massachusetts. The Wall Street Journal reports that Hasbro, the toy company, is going to start making Play-Doh in the United States again for the first time in a decade. Here's the global part, though. Hasbro sold the East Longmeadow factory, in which it makes a bunch of toys and games, and to which it's going to add 20 jobs to make Play-Doh. Sold it to a Belgian company in 2015. Furthermore, the journal quotes a study by the research firm Ibis World that says 98.5% of all toys sold in the United States last year were made someplace else. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up 15 points, barely changed percentage-wise, 20,837. The NASDAQ up 16 points, about a quarter percent, 5861. The S&P 500 added 2 points, about a tenth percent, 2369. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.